tonight on Arena. We review albums from Big Red Machine featuring Taylor Swift, Orla Gartland and Floor Staff. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. We go to television first tonight. Comedy duo Steve Martin and Martin Short are joined by Selena Gomez in a new Disney Plus series called Only Murders in the Building. They play three strangers who live in the same New York building. All three, unbeknownst to each other, are avid followers of the same true crime podcast. But things take a sudden and literal turn when an actual murder takes place in their building. The three come together to solve the crime with their unskilled true crime half-baked theories and notions. I'm joined now by Mary McGill, who's been watching the series for us. So Mary, true crime podcasts have become such a phenomenon over the last few years, both internationally and here in Ireland. What makes them such unusual but still a gripping entertainment?
You know, Kay, I was thinking about this before I came on this evening, and I think there's something about the true crime podcast that appeals to the fascination that humans have always had with the macabre, right? You know, from our ancestors telling stories around the campfire to, you know, the great crime fiction that came out of the Victorian period to our fascination with horror in horror films and so on. And I think the true crime genre, and particularly podcasts, because they can be listened to by millions of people across the world very, very easily, and they're production values on the most popular ones are really, really, really well done. Like if you think of something like Serial kicked off and became a global phenomenon in 2014, if you think of recent hits focused in Ireland, like Where Is George Gibney and West Cork, some they are true crime podcasts, but they're actually, you know, also fantastic examples of investigative journalism. There's a really sophisticated form of storytelling going on, but because the genre has become so popular and its fans are considered to be quite obsessive, it is really rich for a good lampooning. And Only Murders in the Building certainly taps into that potential, but it does something very clever that you just mentioned there. It takes that potential and it takes our fascination with true crime and the podcast genre, and it kind of turns it on its head by absorbing it and making it the central feature of its own very compelling murder mystery. So it puts it right at the heart of its own narrative.
So tell us about the three fans of this podcast, which is All Is Not Okay in Oklahoma. That's Steve Martin, who plays Charles, Martin Short as Oliver, and Selena Gomez then as Maple Mora. They all live in the same building, but either don't know each other or don't pretend to know each other.
Yes, they all lead very atomized lives. So we get this sense of New York, and particularly this beautiful grand apartment building that they live in. You know, they're surrounded in a city of millions of people. They're in an apartment block with hundreds of people. They encounter people in the lobby and in the lift. But do they actually connect with people? Not really. These are three very, very lonely individuals. So if you take Mabel, for example, played by Selena Gomez, who is a longtime stalwart of the kind of the Disney stable, you know, kicking off her career as a child star and has now evolved through music and as branching out now into doing some really interesting work with regard to acting. Mabel is an artist and she's living in her aunt's empty apartment. And when I mean empty, I mean empty. It's all stripped. She has to kind of redesign it. And she's there on her own. And we get a sense that she's very introspective and very isolated. Then we have Oliver Putnam, Martin Short, who is, if you met him, you'd be blown away by his exuberance. He's a big personality, big guy. Not a surprise to learn that he used to be a very successful Broadway producer, but the emphasis is on very, because what people don't realise, apart from his family, is that he hasn't had a hit in years and his finances, as a consequence, are taking a major hit. And if he doesn't get his hands on some financial backing soon, he's going to have to give up his apartment. And then we have the brilliant Steve Martin as Charles Hayden Savage. And he is mourning the end of a relationship. He's also mourning the end, effectively, of his acting career. He used to be a very famous TV detective back in the 90s. And again, we get this meta notion, this nudge, nudge, wink, wink, with regard to how everything is structured in Only Murders in the Building. And so when we when these three characters are thrown together, they're thrown together because they love this particular podcast. But they are also, when you scratch the surface a little bit, they're also thrown together because they are people who are lonely and have, dare I say it, probably far too much time on their hands. But they don't let that stop them from trying to solve what they think is a murder.
So what happens? What murder happens in the building? Or what do they think is a murder that happens in the building?
So they are each alone in their apartments listening to the latest episode of All Is Not Okay in Oklahoma. And this is rudely interrupted by an alarm going off, a fire alarm going off. So they all have to leave. And as luck would have it, the three of them end up crossing paths in a local restaurant, sitting down and having a meal together. And this is when their dedication to this particular podcast becomes clear. When they arrive back to their own building, they are informed that a body has been found on the 10th floor. And they are immediately enthralled by this, which, you know, true crime shouldn't be as compelling as it is because the material is so bleak and so nasty and so painful. But, you know, being fans of the genre, their curiosity is immediately piqued. And they decide to sneak in and see if they can get a glimpse of this of the crime scene, which they do. And they see very briefly the victim before being hurled it out. And because they recognise the victim from earlier in the evening when they encountered him in the elevator, when they hear that it is a suspected suicide, they are immediately not buying it. But it is a very funny exchange, you know, when they're doing this snooping around.
And Mary, we have a clip from that, just that scene where they meet Detective Williams, played by Davine Joy Randolph, who has no time for true crime junkies, and she knows one and knows three of them when she sees them.
His head was, I've seen TV dead bodies. That was, have you ever? He shot himself.
No, he didn't. We saw him, what, like an hour ago? Did he seem like he was going to go do something like that?
Oh. Are you associated with the deceased?
No, no, we don't know him.
We're neighbors in the building. We live in the building.
Yes. Mm-hmm, so you don't know him?
Just in passing.
Not his passing?
No, yes, when we passed by him.
Before he passed.
That's right. But are you sure that it was suicide?
It doesn't make sense.
I mean, even in passing, he didn't seem the type.
So you don't know him?
Look, you're probably just starting your investigation, looking into all the forensics.
God damn it. What fucking podcast are you all hooked on? Huh? I swear to God, if I meet one more true crime nut, this is suicide. It's textbook. Residue powder on the hands, evidence of financial stress. We even found a note on his laptop saying he's out of here, which is exactly where you all need to be.
Now, it's not.
But you know.
No, it's not. So go on ahead and enjoy your cute little lives and be glad that you still have one. You goddamn true crime fucking numbnuts.
Davina Joy Randolph there as Detective Williams. She sees what she has straight away, that they are these numbnuts looking to sneak, you know, to be involved in their own true crime podcast. So how do they go about transforming this tragic death of Tim Kono into a podcast?
Well, they begin by gathering material, okay, which means engaging in activities that are highly questionable from a legal perspective. So they begin snooping around people's apartments, and they quickly establish that Tim had recently ordered what looks to be a very expensive engagement ring. And again, this seems very at odds with the idea that his death is a suicide. And they, as the clues, as they uncover them, begin to mount up, they realise they have the material here potentially for their own true crime podcast. And as they're hashing it out, you know, trying to decide how to go about this, how to record it, they come up with this line that Steve Martin's character says when he refers to, no, we're only going to examine only murders in the building. And they're like, boom, that's it. That's the title for our podcast. But the recording sessions are really, really engaging because they give Steve Martin and Martin Short a real opportunity to spark off each other, which they do so well if you've seen them in action before, you know, Father the Bride and Three Amigos. They tour together regularly. They have a Netflix special, which is called An Evening You Will Forget for the Rest of Your Life. So these are two actors really, really enjoying themselves. And of course, you know, Short's character is a producer and a director, so that's what he knows. Martin's character is an actor, and so they're picking at each other back and forth, and there's some really fantastic comedic flourishes there.
Yes, and she Selena Gomez then playing Mabel has a whole different stream to herself. She seems to have deep secrets of her own. She's reasons maybe for finding out about who killed Tim Kono that are quite personal.
Absolutely. And without giving too much away, let's just say that she isn't exactly upfront about her relationship to Tim Kono from the outset. How that will develop remains to be seen. But she certainly knew something of the victim, and she had a personal connection to him that I think can say is quite significant. Will it help solve the crime? Who knows?
No, and Mary, it doesn't sound like this is a deep insight into the evils of crime reporting or crime fiction. It just seems like a good laugh.
It is. But it's also, there's real heart to it as well, Kay. I will say that. While it jokes and teases about true crime, it also takes the genre seriously, as in, why are people drawn to it, you know? And one of the reasons people are drawn to it is a lot of these true crime phenomena have huge fan communities built around them. You know, people congregate in real life online and they discuss the various episodes. You know, My Favourite Murder, one of the biggest true crime podcasts in Ireland, they've got a fan community called Murderinos. When they come to Ireland, it sells out every single time. So they do tap into what it is about these stories that kind of brings people together around them. And I think that's important as well, because it could just be ripe for satire, you know, and poke fun and laugh. But it takes seriously the kind of, I suppose, emotional connection that people have to these stories and why they have them. And that is a gateway then into exploring the loneliness that is such a feature of these true crime podcast fans that are these motley crew of three amateur sleuths.
Well, Mary McGill, thank you so much for watching Murders in the Building. And it's released by Disney Plus next Tuesday, that's August the 31st. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Rescue Annie is a new play by actor and writer Lauren Shannon Jones and directed by Owen Carrig, about to premiere at this year's Dublin Fringe Festival. It's inspired by the strange but true story that links a famous anonymous death mask from 1880s Paris to the modern CPR mannequin used to teach resuscitating techniques in cases of drowning or heart attacks. Rescue Annie is also inspired by the human need for intimacy and distance, needs thrown into relief in these pandemic times, of course. Lauren Shannon Jones is with me now in studio. Lauren, you just said your father, Morgan Jones, was doing one of the ads there, Home Store and More.
Yeah, I just heard his voice.
You didn't lick it off the stones, obviously. That death mask we're talking about belonged to a woman who drowned in the River Seine in the 1880s. And she became such an icon to writers like Nabokov and Albert Camus. Tell us a little, what do we know about her?
Well, I think there's a long-standing cultural obsession with beautiful dead women. And this one is especially fascinating to certain male artists, maybe because she gives so little, that we know nothing about her. All we know about her is this enigmatic face. So she's sort of like this Mona Lisa figure, and there's a lot of conjecture about who she might have been, what might have caused her to drown herself, but the truth is we don't know anything. She's filled with nothingness, this figure. So I suppose that's why we were drawn to her as well as artists, and why she became this massive artistic obsession.
Right, and they took a death mask off her, from her face. Presumably that was maybe because somebody might identify her later on.
Yeah, well, it was customary at the time in the 1880s. There was actually quite a rash of suicides in Paris that people would jump into the Seine. And they would line up the bodies in the city morgue for people to come by and identify them. And I suppose this was just one step further where the coroner saw this body and was fascinated by how serene she looked. And I suppose this part of the fascination is wondering about, in that moment of death, that peacefulness, you know, like, is there an answer there about the moment of death and what comes after? And so anyway, he called in a sculptor to cast a death mask of this face, and that death mask became really famous and reproduced thousands of times. So this was also around the time when photography was becoming more of a thing, and this idea of reproduction and selling reproductions and reproductions having value. So when this death mask was reproduced, like, it was, you know, you could probably buy one at a stall at the side of the road. And I know Camus had a copy of it hanging over his desk, and many people became quite fixated. I think she also became like a beauty inspiration for like a generation of German girls. It's really strange the way she sort of proliferates through culture, and you can find her in these little pockets through time, you know, these fascinations with this just unknown face.
And then fast forward to when they were doing resuscitation techniques and the idea of having a doll so people could practice this breathing technique, which is really the kiss of life.
Yeah, yeah.
And they chose her face.
Yeah.
For the doll.
Yeah, so it was a toy maker called Asmund Lerdel, and he'd almost lost his son to drowning this year, 1958, the summer before. His son had had a near-death experience when he fell into a body of water, and his father pulled him out, and sort of this instinctive, rudimentary CPR performed on this boy. So when this, I think it inspired him to create this doll that people could use to practice this technique, and he did it.
Staying alive technique,
exactly.
As they say.
He chose this face because a lot of the CPR training at the time was in the army, and he thought that the male soldiers would feel more comfortable kissing a woman, you know. And this, and that's how this L'Inconnue de la Seine, the unknown woman of the Seine, becomes the most kissed face of all time.
How strange.
It is, yeah, isn't it? Quite, yeah, mysterious. Yeah.
So in the play then, just give us a setup for the play, because we have a clip of it here. So yeah. So you're addressing this mysterious, iconic figure.
Yeah. So what we're doing is we're sort of imagining scenarios that might have happened to this person on the last day of her life. So, like, we're taking part in the conjecture as well, you know, we're part of the problem, but we're imagining what might have happened to this person, and certain things that she might have gone through, and certain commonalities she might have with the way we might be feeling after the past year, where we've felt quite isolated, quite alone, quite out of our bodies. And we're doing this through, we're building very immersive sound worlds, and we're using, it's a headphone show, so the audience will be wearing headphones. We're using binaural technology to really put them in the world, you know. And there's something interesting about using headphones as well, because it isolates you as you become part of this collective experience. So there's a kind of a tension there, because I heard Mary saying, you know, you listen to podcasts, you know, it's when you're wearing headphones, you're usually in your own world. So we're using that technique to put the audience in our world.
So in this clip, you're addressing this enigmatic Annie.
Yeah, yeah.
I look at your face, and I see whatever I want to see. And that's how it works.
Or doesn't work. If you never really know someone, then how can you be intimate with them?
So in a way, we're all unknown, Annie. Like you.
I like your name. Maybe I'm here to save you. Rescue Annie, like the doll.
It is so immersive.
Yeah.
You can hear it within your head.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's listening on headphones will have had a really good experience. It doesn't play as well through speakers, but if you're plugged in, you're really hearing, hopefully, the shape of the room and the directionality of it can be quite effective.
And this is going to be on the Peacock stage. Mm-hmm. So there will be people in the audience then with headphones on them.
Yes. Yeah. The numbers are, as you know, quite low. I think we're going to be able to have about 30 people in each performance. So it's, I mean, it's a show that talks about intimacy. It's going to be intimate anyway, because we've got, you know, such a little audience. But also they will be quite isolated in little pockets with the way the seating is being done. So all of these things kind of help the experience as well, you know.
I can imagine. Now, where does Ophelia, the character from the play Hamlet by Shakespeare, where does she come into your play?
Well, there's obvious parallels to draw. We were in the theatre, making theatre, so obviously all that we think about is Shakespeare. And we were thinking about a woman who little was known about, who drowned. And then obviously a parallel is drawn with Ophelia, who is a woman who very little, I mean, she's one of the, I mean, the canon is populated not fully by brutally underwritten female characters. So Ophelia is really, as a character, she's a meditation on nothingness. We don't really know much about what's going on inside her head. You know, she doesn't have a soliloquy like Hamlet does. So we don't know much about her. And then when she drowns at the end, you're left wondering a lot about her, I think. And that's what linked Annie and Ophelia together on the stage.
Yes, and you go through the play then trying to grasp at maybe reasons.
Yeah.
Well, you know, other reasons maybe of what Hamlet did to her to cause this to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Is there some misunderstanding of intimacy that occurred, you know? But yeah, I think you're left wanting with characters like Ophelia. You know, you want more from them, and we weren't given that in the play, so there's this sense of wanting to draw it out a little bit ourselves.
Which has such parallels with yeah. your Rescue Annie. Well, Rescue Annie is at the Abbey Theatre Peacock stage from the 11th to the 18th of September as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. Further details from fringefest.com. Lauren Shannon Jones, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's just coming up to 7:30. No big decisions regarding the electric picnic today when the Cabinet Subcommittee on COVID-19 met. The takeaway for those involved in the arts and music is that there is going to be further engagement over the weekend across government, they say, but they also say with the organisers of the electric picnic. So maybe while there's talking, there's hope. Time now for album reviews. And first up, Orla Gartland, a young Dubliner who has been posting music on YouTube since she was 13 years old. 14 years later, her debut album has been met with a rapturous reception so far in critical circles. Her debut is called Woman on the Internet. Next up is Big Red Machine, a musical project from Aaron Dessner of The National and Justin Vernon of Bon Iver. The collaboration dates back to 2008, and today they release an album whose title begs the question, how long do you think it's going to last? And finally, Floorstaff, the musical moniker of Dublin, Anthony Donnelly. He's been releasing music since 2014. Today his debut album arrives and it's called Attention. Kate Brennan Harding and Alan Corr have been listening, but let's start with Dubliner Orla Gartland and her debut album Woman on the Internet. This is the song Zombie. That's Zombie from Woman on the Internet, sung there by Orla Gartland. Kate, you've been following this artist's career for quite some time. Tell us about her background.
Well, I'm here in Galway and I've just been bashing my head around the place hoping and wishing that we're going to see her play live soon. Orla is amazing. She has been releasing music, as you said earlier, since she was very young. And this is finally her debut album. She released a lot of EPs. She's been featured on Normal People. That kind of set her fan base into a whole other stratosphere. People going, what is that song? I need to find out who this person is. But she's just a really unique artist and she has self-produced. She has released this album on her own record. She is certainly driven. I mean, if you think about it, the reason that she started performing on YouTube was because she couldn't get into open mic nights because she was too young. So she's certainly somebody who has been like completely driven to just make and create art. And Woman on the Internet, for me, is a standout debut.
Alan, can you tell us what the title of the album Woman on the Internet refers to?
Well, she says it's not her. It doesn't refer to Orla Gartland herself. She's an elusive character, according to Orla. Orla, who's actually rechristened herself Orla Chartland, Kay, as of tonight, because this album has gone to number 3 in Ireland and number 10 in the UK. But this kind of woman on the internet is this elusive character, a modern-day Wizard of Oz, she says. So she turns to her when, you know, she doesn't have anyone to turn to in real life. So I think these, you know, she says herself, these songs are songs about growing up, about adulthood, coming for you whether you're ready or not. And she really grapples with all the, I suppose, the hang-ups and paranoias of being 20 and being 26 and 20-something. But she doesn't do it in a piteous way. This is not a pity party. This is a weird kind of and wired, wonderful record in which she goes across a lot of different kind of genres, like kind of straight pop. She's got some kind of like indie rock in there as well. She's also got some beautiful kind of like very nice electronica, modulated electronica. And what a voice, Kay. What a wonderful voice.
What a wonderful voice, yeah. And it's this week's album of the week also on RT Radio 1. And Kate, a zombie, I think both you and Alan like Zombie very much.
Yeah, well, I think so. I like every single song on the album, okay? There's going to be no bones about where my review is going. But Zombie in itself is brilliant and it started to gather more radio play, which is brilliant because obviously we're addressing, like, there has been an imbalance between, you know, gender imbalance on radio. So perhaps Orla is pushing through, like, all the amazing female talent that is pushing through from Ireland. But I love, there's so many songs on the album that I absolutely love, like Bloodline and Difficult Things. I'm not sure if you're going to play a bit of that. I love that one too because it's centred around her family and she's never written anything about her family. And most of the songs on this album are actually, yes, it's about coming of age, but it's about exploring maybe where her own head has been at. And she wrote this during lockdown, but it's not a lockdown album. And what she had to do was draw on sort of influences and stuff, ideas that she'd had from before lockdown, before the pandemic happened, because she wasn't going out and meeting friends and sort of just, you know, having new ideas and new emotions and new feelings. So, except for the lockdown side of things. And she deliberately didn't want to release anything that was maudlin or captured just this one specific moment in time. She wanted this to just kick through and be positive kind of body work, I guess.
Well, in case we all have a love in about Orla Gartland, I've picked a track that you and Alan may disagree on. This is More
sure.
Like You. That's Woman from Woman on the Internet. That's More Like You from Orla Gartland. Kate, there it is very much Woman on the Internet is referenced there again.
Mm-hmm. It's
I want to
time,
be
yeah.
like somebody else. It's that whole projecting oneself into that whole world of the internet where you can get life models that you may like a little bit more than yourself.
Yeah, and like this song was actually written about, you know, her best friend's best friend, who she said that she doesn't really know very well, but, you know, they have this woman in common. Their best friend is in common. And she said it's kind of came about from comparing herself to her best friend's best friend. And then she says that she seeks solace when she goes on the internet and sort of kind of finds comfort there. So I kind of love that. It's taken on a life of its own because loads of people think it's just about, you know, maybe an ex, or it's about some sort of failed love, but it's not. It's actually about friendships and our inner workings of like trying to be like somebody.
Yeah, you were less sure of this one, though I think on the whole you love most of the tracks, Alan.
I mean, that song in particular, I think Orla has this, you know, real gift for these sweet and airy ballads with a wounded heart. That song, More Like You, was a bit kind of conventional compared to the rest of the album. I mean, it's a very good song. There are better songs on here, as Kate said. I mean, nearly everything here, and particularly Bloodlines, is the best thing on it. But what I really enjoyed about this the most, Kay, is that she's racked by those insecurities and hang-ups, but she's bluntly honest. But she has also the decency to be very smart and very funny about her life and her particular kind of hang-ups and problems. And she explores that very, very well in a way that people can really empathise with.
And yeah. Musically, Kate...
Well, it's interesting to know just about More Like You, if that one stands out to you, Alan, because that was produced with Tommy King, who produced Vampire Weekend and Haim. So maybe there's a more kind of swinging into the commercial pop side of things. Mm. But like the musicality, like I love her brutal honesty, but I also love the layering that she does. I love that she jumps around genres. Like she is pop and then suddenly you can just get the guitar out and you can mosh. Like there's so many different kind of layers to it. I think it's creating something that's a bit different in the chart world.
Okay, let's listen to a little bit of another track. This is called Do You Mind?
Come take it all, I wanna know if you're trying to be honest. Then why did you break your promise? Oh, you said you were mine, I wanna fall for you again. So much easier the first time. Long before the decline, you forgot that you said you were mine. How are you so mechanical? I was shouting, you just nodded. Was it everything you wanted?
So that's Do You Mind from Woman on the Internet by Orla Gartland. That voice, it's a very strong instrument, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she says herself that she's heavily influenced by Joni Mitchell and Regina Spektor and Imogen Heap, an artist we don't hear half enough about, if you ask me. I think she's got that purity going on, but there's also a kind of a very quirky edge which lends her that real personality. There's a couple of tracks here, especially the opener, reminds me a bit of something from Fiona Apple's last album, Fetch the Bolt Cutters, as well as Sleater Kinney. So I think that, you know, her voice does have a lot of variation and a lot of kind of interesting quirks going on.
Stars out of five, Alan?
I would give this 4 out of 5, and it's also worth noting, Kay, she does a very nice line in Socks.
Socks?
Yes.
How do you know such a niche?
She sells socks
thing?
on her wonderful website. Anyone who's nostalgic about the internet in the 1990s should check out Orla Chartland's website. It's very nostalgic and vintage looking.
All right. Do you know about your socks, Kate?
I do, yes.
Oh, very good.
Just reminded me I must buy some.
And stars out of five?
I'm giving this 5 out of 5. To me, it is one of the albums of the year from Ireland.
Okay, 4 out of 5 and 5 out of 5 for Woman on the Internet by Orla Gartland. Next up, the second studio venture from The National's Aaron Dessner and Bon Iver's Justin Vernon, two musicians who have been collaborating on and off since 2008. What brought them together, Alan?
Well, this is the second album from a side project, I suppose, from Aaron Dessner and Bon Iver, who is Justin Vernon, of course. And they came about in about 2017. I think for Aaron Dessner to explore, you know, a more sonic side, more kind of sense of sonic adventurism than he might get from The National. And I have a bit of a confession to make here, Kay. I think The National are the most overrated bands of Flaming Lips. And I know this statement is blasphemy here in Ireland. And it's, you know, Ireland has come somewhat of a spiritual home for The National following their early success here about 20 years ago. But I've never really taken to them. So this is a side project. On this second album, Aaron and Bon Iver are joined by the likes of the great Robin Pecknold from Fleet Foxes, Anance Mitchell, Lisa Hannigan's on here. But most of all, Taylor Swift is involved.
And we know Aaron Dessner and Taylor Swift collaborated.
They very much have history. I mean, he worked with her on her last two brilliant albums, Folklore and Evermore. So basically, they've got a real kind of simpatico going on there musically.
Yes, because we're going to play Renegade Kate, and they wrote this following their Grammy success. Am I right?
Yeah, they were they picked up the Grammy and then they went and wrote this song together. But I think there was probably shades of Desner having kind of got the blueprint of these tracks beforehand. And obviously working with Swift, I think they've created such an amazing collaboration that, you know, it made sense that she would be on this album.
And might help sell a few old records as well, I suppose. This is Renegade. Carry your baggage up my street, make me your future history. It's time you've come a long way. Open the blinds, let me see your face. You wouldn't be the first renegade to need somebody. Is it insensitive for me to say, get your shit together? So that's Renegade from How Long Do You Think It's Going to Last? I think it was Taylor Swift also came up with the title of the album, and that's from Big Red Machine. So it's a continuation, really, Kate, of their collaboration on Folklore.
Yeah, it is. But the thing that's really interesting about Big Red Machine is that they've been going for so long. And Aaron Dessner, for anyone who doesn't know, he is heavily involved, especially with Justin, in creating live music and generating collaboration. They've done stuff in Cork with Sounds from a Safe Harbour. They are frequently in Ireland doing kind of just these. I think he just really enjoys bringing his music to somebody and seeing what somebody else transforms it into. So this album is 15 songs now. I think 15 songs is a bit too long for the album. I think there's a few could have been cut. But he clearly, both Vernon and him, are really, really relishing bringing in all the pals that they've been making over the last number of years. And it feels that it's something that breaks down the genres specifically in terms of, like, Taylor Swift. She's a multi-stadium, one of the biggest artists in the world, alongside our own Lisa Hannigan, alongside Sharon Van Etten. There's just some class singers in here, and it's all for the love of music. And I think that's what's really nice about this project.
Aaron Dessner isn't known to be he's not the lead singer in the National, and he's not seen to be a singer a lot of times on the songs.
No, Matt Berninger is the lead singer in the National, and Aaron, I think, as far as I know, sings for the first time on this album, and he sings on three songs on this, and I think he's gotten a very, very impressive voice, in particular Brycey, which is an ode to his twin brother and National bandmate, Bryce Dessner. And I think this is a beautiful, lovely, kind of plangent acoustic song. And I think elsewhere he sounds like a less bummed out Elliot Smith. So there's some lovely vocal work here by Dessner.
He was a nice surprise in it.
He was a nice surprise for me. It's also worth noting, strangely enough, that a Big Red Machine sounds like a conflation between Taylor Swift's record company name, Big Machine, and the title of her fourth album, Red, as a, for a bit of boring pop trivia.
Haven't you been
it just occurred to me. I mean, there are some very nice things on here, including Hutch, which is...
Yes, we have Hutch now. Will you just talk us into this?
Well, this is a beautiful song which is dedicated to Aaron's late friend, Frightened Rabbits frontman, Scott Hutchinson, who unfortunately passed away in the last couple of years. And Dessner produced his final album. And this is very much an appeal for those struggling with depression. And it's one of the standouts for me on the album.
And I think for you too, Kevin.
Hello.
Hutch there, featuring Lisa Hannigan, Justin Vernon and Big Red Machine. And that's from their album that we're reviewing, How Long Do You Think It's Going to Last? Kate, overall, what did you make of Big Red Machine's latest venture?
Well, I just, do you know the Big Red Machine is the nickname for the Cincinnati Red Sox, and that's
why... Oh, would you just stop now? You're outdoing each other.
I know, but
Alan knew that as well.
Yeah, that's where, because he, like, Desner's from Cincinnati and it's a big childhood nostalgia buzz going on around it. But for me, it took me a long time to get into the album. I actually didn't like it at the start because it's so the same tone, but then it began to sort of reveal more of itself to me. So I began really liking it, and I really like it, but I do think it could be shorter.
I think you found it a bit of a slog as well, Alan.
I'm afraid I did. There's some really excellent things on here. Phoenix with the great Robin Pecknold from Fleet Foxes. It sounds like something a Jackson Brown song, you know, singing a great lost track by the band. Stuff like Latter Days is very good as well. But I had the same problem with this that I have with The National. I think it's a bit studied, a bit worthy, and maybe a bit, you know, self-indulgent. It's the kind of album that I find easier to admire than actually love, I think, Kay.
Oh, right. And when you're admiring something, how many stars do you give them out of five?
Oh, admiring five out of... I think I would give this three out of five, a kind of fairly qualified
and
three
Kate,
out of five.
Admiring or loving? Neither.
I'm admiring, I do love The National and I do love what Mark Berninger brings to the rock and roll side of The National. But for me, this just, it's friends who are indulging themselves and it is beautiful and there are beautiful elements, but it is 3 out of 5 for me as well.
Okay, 3 out of 5 from both of you for Big Red Machines. How long do you think it's going to last? Finally, Dublin musician Anthony Donnelly, a.k.a. Floorstaff, released his debut album today. It has certainly been a long time coming for Donnelly, who took 4 years off to work on this eagerly awaited collection of songs. Let's listen to Aspiration.
A line to you, I don't think I'm getting better. Focused in words and cruel, I just couldn't write that letter.
That's Aspiration from the new album by Floorstaff, and that's the album is called Attention. Kate, who is Anthony Donnelly? Who is Floorstaff?
He's a very interesting songwriter. He's been releasing a number of EPs, obviously, as he said, and then he took 4 years off, sort of went and was teaching music, and he moved to Kilkenny. He moved to a rural location there, and he has spoken about how that love of teaching music sort of gave him back a passion for creating his own, and also then having the time in this rural location meant that he could think about and process stuff that had happened to him in his life. So it's thematically the very honest album. It's about loss and regret, but it does have this kind of silver lining through it. So, and I just keep hearing, like, there must be really good influences. I hear sounds like I can hear a bit of Bell X1 in there, and I can hear a little bit of Peter Gabriel. There's kind of like unique ways he uses his voice.
And Alan, did you think that R&R he did in Kilkenny, do you think he got back his songwriting groove?
Well, he's an unknown quantity to me, so I don't know what his groove was before he moved to Freshford and then to Como, as Kate was saying. His partner's from Como in northern Italy. And it's I think that he's a very, very fine songwriter, and he's got this kind of, you know, ability to compose these very spacious and airy kind of, you know, rock songs, very sophisticated rock songs, this monolithic epicness almost. Sounds like, you know, one part introspection, two parts liberation. Reminds me very much of Talk Talk, Bark Psychosis, a Dublin band called Subplots, also Perfume Genius. And vocally, as well as Peter Gabriel, I can hear Guy Garvey in there from Elbow, even Paul Buchanan from The Blue Nile. So fairly overwrought vocals, but they're tempered by these very lush harmonic arrangements that really work very well.
Yes, Kate, I think you saw Elbow and you saw even Roy Orbison there.
Yeah, well, there's a track called Empathize. There's a track called Mindset, which is my favourite song on the album. And it's more that it's like his vocals are not Roy Orbison, but you know the way a lot of listeners might know, if Roy Orbison used to build and build and build the emotion. Like, think, for example, you know the song In Dreams. And
yes.
Anybody listening, the way Roy Orbison sort of brings it up to this big crescendo. Well, in Mindset, Anthony Floorstaff does that very well.
Well, let's listen to Mindset. I'm just giving you a little warning here because there's explicit in brackets beside it. That's Mindset from Attention from Floorstaff.
Did you hear Roy Orbison there? Did you hear In Dreams, Ellen?
I actually did. Mm-hmm. I could hear the build very much so, but that's him at his most Guy Garvey, I think. He really sounds like Guy on Elbow's debut and best album, Asleep at the Back, from 1999. I mean, elsewhere on the album is, you know, Beach Boys harmonising as well. And it's very much worth mentioning the band that Anthony has on this album. He's got himself on guitar, piano, bass and synthesizers, but he's backed by Christopher Barry on electric guitar, synthesizers, the great Oisín Trench on drums, and Garrett Quinn Redmond on violin. So, you know, it really is a very sumptuous, beautiful orchestral album that doesn't forget, you know, his pop roots and how to write very memorable, you know, lyrics and very memorable melodies.
Kate, you picked the Occupants Rotate as well.
I did, yeah. It's kind of like the sprinkling of his influences. Like, he's actually quite a big Enya fan. Now, there isn't Enya in this, but there's sort of Simply Red. It's kind of a 1980s soul pop sound. Like, it's kind of timeless in that way, in a good way. And I really liked that it had like a softly nuanced melody. Yeah, I particularly liked that song.
So, Alan, you're new to Anthony. What did you make of it?
Oh, I absolutely adore this. I think this is, you know, absolutely superb. I think Anthony Donnelly is clearly a man who knows a lot about the human condition, and some of the lyrics on this album are very moving indeed and very, very emotive. He has a real sense of kind of understanding and empathy with people who might have gone through emotional struggles of their own, which he clearly has. But I think this is an album which he kind of shakes free the forged manacles of the mind, and he dwells on the dark stuff, but he really strikes out on liberation here and finds fresh space to find happiness, really, I think, Kay.
And overall, Kay, did you find it a satisfying listen?
I have found it a very satisfying listen. I still need to go back and listen more. I think he's building his identity. I think he's, as Alan said, he's broken whatever shackles he had before, but I'm looking forward to the next body of work as well, because I think he's really beginning to own his identity as a songwriter.
Oh, I feel you're going to be generous with stars, Alan.
A very strong 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. And from you, Kate?
It's actually a 3 out of 5 for me.
Oh, right, because you're waiting for what's next.
I'm just, yeah, I need a bit more, yeah.
So Anthony Donnelly, our floor staff, attention. And that the other albums was Big Red Machines, How Long Do You Think It's Gonna Last? Orla Gartland was Woman on the Internet. My thanks to Kate Brennan Harding and Alan Corr. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Leah Murphy. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Elizabeth Larry. Sean is back on Monday.